It is time for the Berkshire Edge on Air. Of course, they're always online, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at berkshireedge.com. But once a week, they get together with us here at Robinhood Radio, and we talk about just some of the stories you'll find. We welcome everybody in again this morning. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And how are you in South County this morning?
Well, it's a beautiful day.
It's about 70 degrees out there.
Yeah, that's what
summer.
It is.
Great.
Summer's here.
That's all right. You'll be...
It was a very brief fall and an even briefer winter.
We'll talk to you on Saturday.
Well,
pardon?
We'll talk to you on Saturday.
Saturday.
Oh. Is it cold on Saturday?
Yeah, so, well, Saturday night, I think Pat said it'd get down into the 30s. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So,
well, we're going to Chicago.
Oh, it's already cold there.
Yeah, is it already? That's what I'm worried. I have to check the weather. We're going to a conference of
online newspapers.
There's an organization of them.
Called Lion.
Yeah, it stands for Local Independent Online News Publishers.
Uh-huh.
Lion Publishers.
Well.
We go every year and we find out what our colleagues around the country are doing.
And they picked Chicago this time. One of the fun.
They're always in Chicago. It's midway between both coasts, more or less.
There's a reason it's the second city.
They have a college use facility.
Right. Okay.
All right. Well, we will move away from.
We will
Chicago.
Lionize you.
Yeah.
We
will come back to South County in our region, and the first story: addiction in the Berkshires. Sarah's story.
Oh yeah, this is really. I mean, this is a three-part story.
Well, it's a four-part story. We've done three. The fourth part goes tonight or tomorrow morning. And it's one of our best writers, Sheila Clary, interviewed a young woman who has been suffering from addiction to heroin and started off with opioids and got into heroin, and she... her first person account of how she slipped into this dependency and what it did to her life. It's really quite moving.
Well, the great thing about how you're presenting the story is you're presenting the third part now, but part one and two for people that are just hearing about it are also up online as well.
Oh, they are. Yeah. You bet. There are links to them, and it's in her voice. You know, Sheila, what Sheila did was record her many 15 hours of, conversations with this young person, and then she re-recorded it. I mean, she wrote it from those from her recordings, and it's really moving. And you can see how this kind of came upon her. She said that, you know, she was an A student in high school and 98th percentile on all the tests, she said. She was taking ballet, and she said, you wouldn't have thought I would end up this way.
That's right.
All my teachers thought I had a lot of promise and would do well in life.
Well, but she also talks about how, you know, she's incapable of stopping, that it wasn't just that the availability was there or that she liked it. She said once she started, she realized that she had an addictive personality and she couldn't stop, which is, you know, very frightening because it's not, you know, people tend to condemn addicts because, you know, for moral interpretation.
Well, they stigmatize them, yeah.
Yeah, but here's this young woman saying, you know, I just couldn't help it.
Well, the opioid crisis is one of those things, thanks to some major pharmaceutical companies and doctors who just didn't understand, is a crisis that it was man-made, created.
Man-made crisis. And
set up people of... I think what people are also starting to find is people who are now 70 and 80 years old, more and more doctors and places are finding these people have been given opioids from their 60s on. And And this is a crisis that has not even close to coming to reach its crest of the wave in this country. I mean, because you have years of these pills being prescribed unregulated, basically.
Right.
And there's there's so many people that are hidden addicts out there that don't know it yet.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that, remember, as I seem to recall reading accounts of people using pills, remember? It used to be pills.
Yeah.
Diet pills, and weight loss pills, and what were they? Oh, and sleeping pills, various kinds of sedatives. That used to be quite common, actually, that people would just really... I'm not sure whether they were addictive, but
there was a diet pill back in the 70s that was legally prescribed by doctors, just like the opioids, was called White Cross to anybody who took it.
Oh, really?
And it was being distributed literally by the barrels. And how do I know? Because when I was 400 and some odd pounds in the 70s, I went to a doctor who prescribed these pills at 100 to 200 at a time.
Oh, my God.
But, and you could give them away.
Right.
To your friends, right?
And then even more recently, when you had your surgeries, before opioids were officially labeled, this is only 2.5 years ago, which is not very much. You know, the way these things were, and in some cases still are, being lashed out is just,
Well, Jill knows the story. When I got out of the hospital for my third surgery, the doctor gave me a prescription. I was getting tramadol, but all of a sudden I get home and I give the guy who's driving my prescription. He goes in, he comes out. There was a prescription with a refill of 100 Oxycontin. 100.
Oh,
100.
My God.
And this is
unbelievable.
But this is hospital for special surgery. It's not like, oh, and that's what's really important for people to understand is A, it's been prevalent, B, it's silent, and C, it's not just, it's far-reaching, let's just say.
And that's what's important about presenting a story like this that somebody gives in their own words, is that maybe people who are now currently taking these can understand that, well, maybe it's time I ease down through my doctor and find a way to get onto something other than this.
Right.
Well, it's quite a story.
Yeah, we'll see what the fourth
installment
coming out tonight.
All right. Yeah. All right, well, we will.
I think it's quite far more common than people realize. Oh,
absolutely.
Well, we publish obituaries, and we, unlike most of the other publications that we know, we don't charge people for obituaries. You know, we feel that it's part of the community record, and we also do births, but we do a lot more deaths. And, you know, we notice that we are regularly getting obituaries with, you know, young people and no stated cause of death.
Yeah.
You know, so-and-so died suddenly, or just no description of why they died at all. And, you know, we know that it's some sort of opium addiction or opiate addiction.
Overdose.
We have these young people with no cause of death, and we see it very regularly.
All right. Well, let's move on to our second story, because once again, I love the way you titled this. I don't know whether Marcy or David wrote it, but once again, into the breach of the Berkshire Hills Regional School Committee.
Renovated. It's a Shakespearean drama.
Renovation of the 50-year-old Monument Mountain Regional High School.
Oh, yes. Well, the school committee is, once again, the Berkshire Hills Regional School Committee, which is consists of Stockbridge, Great Barrington, and West Stockbridge have been mulling over for a number of years now how to upgrade the high school, which is 50 years old, and the roof leaks and a number of other problems, structural problems with it, and they need to upgrade it. And a few years ago, 4 years ago, they had a proposal to rebuild a new high school, which the voters turned down, even though they were receiving quite a bit of assistance from the Massachusetts School Building Authority. And so they're looking at it again. But at the same time, you know, school districts are looking, in the Berkshires, are looking at consolidation because of the decline in the number of students. So this is a, you know, the public education is between a rock and a hard place in the Berkshires, you know. Literally.
It's not.
Because it's, you know, the school infrastructure needs upgrading, but on the other hand, the number of students is declining.
This is a problem that goes into New York State, into Connecticut, in our whole area.
Yep.
It's just it's a problem that only has one answer, and that is you have to get more young families to move and be able to live in this area.
That's right.
And
that means they need a place to live, they need a job.
That's it, and you need a tax base.
And you need high speed internet.
Yeah,
really good high speed internet.
But all of those things, you know, it's like if this is going to work, it's a bigger infrastructure, problem than just the let's focus on declining enrollment.
I don't know if you've seen it up there, but to me, it is a bigger problem than a school problem. It's a school, town, county problem that everybody has to work together to find a way to solve the problems, to lay the base, so then you can reinvest back in your schools again.
Right.
Well, I'll tell you, this reminds me of an interesting conversation I had a number of years ago with the head of the Berkshire Regional Planning Commission and the Berkshire Natural Resources Council. We were sitting around thinking about would it be a good idea to promote the idea of a rail transportation network that would connect to New York City and Boston to make it easier to get to the Berkshires area in a more fuel-efficient, you know, environmentally friendly way. And I was so surprised to find that these officials of these planning organizations were saying, oh, no, we don't want to bring more people here.
Well, they don't say that anymore.
Yeah, right.
No, but they did.
Right. No,
there was this, you know, we have this pristine, sacred little paradise, and we don't want to despoil it by inviting visitors in.
I think there was a time when people were really worried that we were going to turn into the Hamptons, you know, with heavy traffic every weekend. We have anyway. We have heavy traffic every weekend. We have more second home owners.
We don't have any way
for people to earn a living here.
And we need these young people to come to our area because we need help on our fire departments, our ambulance squads. I mean,
That's right.
You name it. It's so much bigger than a school problem, but the school problem magnifies it so perfectly well. That's why I don't understand why leaders
now that we're talking about this, it seems to me that maybe what needs to be done is we're looking at this in these little isolated areas. We're looking at schools, we're looking at economic development, we look at transportation, but nobody's looking at them all together.
Yeah,
you know,
that's exactly
and that's
right.
What needs to be done. It's all, as you were saying, all of one, it's all of a package. All of these things have to be thought of as one big problem or one big challenge, you know.
And you need to lay the groundwork. I ran for a board of education 7 years ago, and people laughed at me when I did not talk about education. I talked about taxpayers. I talked about funding schools, and I talked about declining enrollment, how we needed to work together, and only lost by about 100-some votes. But that was 7 years ago, and now it's 7 years later, and the problem around here and obviously in South County is the same and getting worse. Not much we can do about it unless all the officials could get together on this.
Well, you could run for the school board again.
No, thank you. once was enough. All right. On that note, let's move on to the next story. And that is your feature writer's got a profile on a fine food market in Great Barrington.
Oh yeah. Well, this is one of those nice stories. Yeah, Hannah Vinsego, we have a great little market here, fine food market, Bazalians, and it's south of Great Barrington, and it's run by two wonderful people who are French, and
he's French.
He's
Irish.
And she's Irish. Jean-Francois and Helen Bazalian, and they have this great little fine food market, and it's just a treasure. So Hannah, our writer, just did a little profile of them, and it's just so sweet, you know. I just love every so often writing stories about these little treasures that we have, and you know, that people know about. And Bazalians is certainly one of them.
Yeah, it's 15 years old.
And it's having its birthday. It's 15 years old. So we have a little birthday celebration for Bazalians.
Right. But, you know, what I especially love about it is Jean-Francois, who is the husband of the couple, he indulges me in speaking French, and apparently he does that with a lot of people. So, you know, everybody goes in there, every Francophile in the area goes in and practices their French on poor Jean-Francois. I'm surprised he can speak French anymore, having heard, you know, all these atrocious mistakes. I'm surprised he actually can remember what the language sounds like.
No, that's bread in the bone, I'm sorry.
I know, and they go back to France every year.
But it's also, like I used to say, when you're a music teacher and in your elementary school, yes, you get a few prodigies, but other than that, you really have to be patient, and because there's no way that the music is going to be played no matter how
well. I'll never forget just absolutely being crushed when I got up the nerve to order an orange juice on a flight to France.
And
I did it wrong, of course. And the attendant looked at me and said, "Je d'orange." I was like, "Okay."
What did he say?
Je d'orange. I said juice. I said orange juice, d'orange, and he said je d'orange. I was like, okay. You're deranged too. It sounds that was just. But then he would have to use the vous form. The point is that.
I know they are not generous.
They are not generous. It is not kind.
So I spent a year in France when I was in college, and it was a while ago. But they are not forgiving.
No. So you definitely need therapy.
Come out with two words of French, and they say, two words of Italian, and they say, you speak Italian.
That's right. It's so different.
You struggle with a whole sentence in France, and they sort of look down on you and walk away.
Insect.
That's kind of like this country's getting.
The point is, you just need therapy for it. If people are, getting fussed about what they're getting fussed about now, I do not recommend junior year abroad.
Well, happy birthday. Happy birthday to Bazalians. And our final story is out of the real estate section.
Yes. So, this is sort of my baby, the real estate section. And David was very generous. It on the list, but
I thought it was sort of a funny story.
It's an interesting story. We have among the many interesting features in our real estate section, we have a column called Transformations, where we have interior designers or architects or landscape designers write articles on things, so sites or things that they have transformed. And this week we have an article that I think will be of great interest to people because it's about whether to upholster or to buy new furniture. In other words, if I really think it's really whether to upholster or throw out. But, we cling to these old pieces of furniture. We think that we're going to reupholster them and they're going to look beautiful. But we have an article by Sue Schwartz, who's We've got a practice called Gallery 315 Home, which used to be in Sheffield, but is now in Lakeville. And she's
yes.
a very talented designer. We have run several articles by her, including one that she did about a year ago about how she and a partner who's a stager for real estate agents, they can, you buy a house, they will furnish it,
yeah.
it'll be ready for you to move in and live in completely in about 6 weeks. They will, you know, they'll find furniture, they'll find dishes, silverware, glasses, everything. It'll be move in as if you'd already always been there in about 6 weeks. And now she's right, and she's written us several interesting articles, but this one I think is very interesting about how you decide. You have that couch that you've been loving for years, and you're upgrading or updating your decor. Can you save the couch, or is it time to just get rid of it and buy something new? So for anybody who's thinking of reupholstering, this is a good article to look at.
Well, it's
full of interesting information
and
tips and pictures of you know pieces of furniture that she has transformed with just the right choice of new fabric.
When I was 16, my mother decided to reupholster all her furniture that she had purchased when she was married to my dad, which was before I was born. So the furniture was already about 25, 30 years old, and
yeah.
everybody told her not to do it, but she did it, and my brother is using that furniture now. I have three or four pieces of that furniture in my house now, and it's interesting because it's totally different than what you see out today, but
yeah.
the quality of the workmanship, you'll never see something
that well made and that well crafted.
And that survived four kids
yeah.
after 70 years.
Because we became that disposable. But if you get a piece
years.
Like that, you know, I don't know, I'm a big proponent. Plus, I came up with people who actively reupholstered. That's what you did. That's how you changed
but
it.
Every time I look at a piece of this furniture, either my brother or my mom, I say, my gosh, it's 70 years old.
Or yeah. you replace the then upholstery
yeah.
so that you to freshen it up, because it fades when there's light and dust.
Yes,
and,
yes.
So.
Well, take a look at this article. It's very interesting because she talks about, you know, you have to factor in the price of fabric. You have to be careful that sometimes when you take off the fabric, the piece requires structural improvement, and you know, and that can be
absolutely. Some appraisers told my brother and I that, you know what, keep this furniture and change it, because if you're going to replace it with stuff that's of equal size, you're going to spend $10,000 where you're going to spend to repair and stuff like that only about $1,000, and that's what
wow.
my brother ended up doing. So it's
wow.
a great story to pass along to people, though.
Yes. Well, read the article by Sue Schwartz.
Yeah, she's great.
I mean, she's a very talented designer, and she writes for us regularly. And, so we're very grateful to her for doing this.
All right.
She always comes up with interesting ideas.
And there's more stories than this in the Berkshire Edge. But we're out of time. So just remember the simple words, theberkshireedge.com, theberkshireedge.com. And we'll speak to you guys next week.
Yep.
Yeah.
We'll be on.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
That is this week and the Berkshire Edge on air and online.